Chapter 19. We stood in silence, turning on our heels to survey the great panorama of destruction. The unfolding story of the panels was interrupted, on one wall, by a doom painting showing the righteous ascending to heaven, while below, the pale naked sinners were thrown into hell. But even that image lacked the sharp colours and vivid scenes of the Revelation story. For the first time, I felt its full power. Barak went up to the panels to take a closer look, his footsteps echoing on the tiles. He stopped before a portrayal of a great beast with seven snake-like necks issuing from its powerful shoulders, at the end of each, a snarling head crowned with either one or two horns. Before it, his head framed by a gold-leaf halo, stood the figure of St. John, the witness of what was to come, his expression full of fear. I joined him. "So that's what the beast with seven heads and ten horns looked like," I said. "I couldn't imagine it somehow." The style of the paintings was that of 200 years ago, the figures lacking the realistic fluidity we had achieved in these latter days. But it was vivid and terrifying nonetheless. "The Westminster monks saw this," I said quietly. "Goddard, Lockley, Cantrell. Every day, in chapter." "Yes, this could eat into a man's soul."
"Lockley the lay brother wouldn't have come to chapter, would he?" Barak asked.
"A lot of other business would be done in the chapter house. He'd have seen the panels often."
Harsnett joined us.
"The papers say we have given the Bible to people who can't understand its message, who were driven to wild interpretations.
But see, Master Shardlake, pictures may have the same effect. If this room had been slubbered over with whitewash like a good reformed church, Goddard might never have had his mind turned.
I think the devil came to him through these pictures."
"If it is Goddard?"
"Yes, if, but he seems the most likely."
I looked at him. "Is this what the Dean was hiding from us? Did he remember this panorama, perhaps the effect it had on someone?"
Harsnett set his lips.
"That we shall discover.
Sergeant Shardlake, I'll see the Dean again tomorrow. Can you talk to those other two ex-monks, see what they know? Let us build up our knowledge before we confront Benson again."
"I will," I said. "After court today, if I may." He nodded agreement.
"And I will send word to the Common Council of London. Someone there may know of Goddard's family."
"I should like to take a look at what's left of the infirmary buildings before we go."
"Yes, we should do that."
Harsnett cast a last look of distaste round the chamber, then led the way out. I paused at a panel showing a grim-faced angel, winged and clad in white, pouring liquid onto an earth that was turned to fire. Agonized white faces pierced the flames.
"The fourth vial," I murmured to Barak. "Dear God, I hope we catch him before he butchers someone else."
Outside in the cloister, we asked another clerk where the old infirmary buildings were. He told us the monks' infirmary was demolished now, but that the lay infirmary, which had cared for the poor of the parish, lay a little distance off through the old monk's graveyard. The rain ceased as we left the cloister and crossed a path through a grassy square dotted with headstones, some going back centuries. As with all the dissolved monasteries, the stones would soon be dug out, the coffins disinterred, and the bones thrown into a communal pit. The infirmary was a long, low building, apart from the main complex to safeguard against plague. The heavy wooden door was unlocked. Inside was a bare chamber dimly lit by high, dusty windows. Nothing left but rags of cloth in the corners, marks on the walls where pictures and a large cross had hung, and an empty fire grate with mouse droppings scattered around.
"Where do the Westminster patients go now?"
I asked quietly, thinking of Roger's hospital plans. His face seemed to appear again before me, smiling cheerfully and nodding.
"They have nowhere," Hasnett answered sadly.
We all turned quickly as the door creaked. Someone was trying to open it, slowly and stealthily. Barak put his hand to his sword as an extraordinary figure crept into the room. An old man with a thatch of untidy fair hair like a bird's nest, thin and ragged, his cheeks fallen in. He hadn't seen us, and as we watched, he took a long twig he had found somewhere and began poking at the rubbish in one of the corners.
"What are you doing here?"
Harsnett's clear voice echoing around the chamber made the intruder start violently. He dropped his twig, clutched his hands together in front of his chest, and stared at us in fear.
"Well?"
Harsnett asked. He cowered away.
I wasn't doing any harm, sir."
His voice was slurred, unintelligible, and at first I thought he was drunk. But then I realised he was toothless. I also saw that he was actually a younger man, his sunken cheeks making him look older.
"You came here for a reason," Harsnett went on. "You're in the middle of the Abbey precinct. You didn't just wander in."
"I was looking for my teeth,"
he said, wringing his hands and backing away.
"I keep hoping I'll find them in a corner, somewhere I haven't looked, somewhere at Westminster."
There was a look of baffled helplessness in his wide blue eyes, and I wondered if the fellow was an idiot.
"All right, but leave us,"
Harsnett said more gently, evidently coming to the same conclusion. The man scurried out and closed the door behind him with the same slow creaking motion, as though afraid of disturbing us further with the noise.
"What in Jesus' name was all that about?"
Barak asked.
"Some poor beggar out of his wits," Harsnett said. "They're everywhere at Westminster. Evidently they can even find their way in here. The guard should be told."
He frowned at Barak.
"And I would be grateful if you didn't take the Lord's name in vain."
Barak's eyes glinted. Far away I heard the clock tower strike 10. "I have to be at court," I said. "Barak, come quickly. I'm sorry, Master Coroner, but we must go. I'll report to you once I've seen those two ex-monks." We walked back with Harsnett to the main gate and out into the busy precinct. It had come to life now, the shops busy, people milling around. Seeing us, a couple of peddlers hurried over. One carried a tray full of old jars, the stink of their contents reaching us from yards away.
"Oil from the great fish, masters," he called, "full of magical properties."
Barak waved him away. A skinny hand clutched at my robe and I half turned to see a ragged woman holding a pale, skinny baby.
"Feed my child," she said.
I turned away before she could meet my eye, remembering the stories that beggar women would keep their babies hungry to arouse pity. Or was that just another story we told ourselves to salve our consciences as we made these people invisible? As we headed into the gate leading into Thieving Lane, I saw there was a melee outside one of the shops. A middle-aged man and his wife, both looking frightened, stood outside between two parish constables. Two more constables were heaving battered chests from inside the shop, while another rummaged through a third chest set on the muddy ground. It seemed to contain a variety of outlandish costumes. The crowd that had gathered looked sour and hostile, and I noted the blue coats of several apprentices. A little gang of beggars had made for the crowd, scabby and scurvy, some breechless and wearing skirts of cloth. Among them were a couple of women, young perhaps, but with leathery, weather-beaten faces, passing a leather bottle between them and laughing.
"No books yet,"
the constable searching through the chest said.
"We've no forbidden books," the shopkeeper pleaded. "All we do is supply costumes for plays. It's our livelihood. Please."
"Aye," the constable beside them said. "For companies that perform John Bales plays and other heretical rubbish."
There was an angry murmur from the crowd. His colleague lifted sets of false whiskers from the chest, making one of the drunken women laugh wildly.
"They're bringing the purge to Westminster too," Harsnett muttered angrily. "That was what Bonner was doing down here."
"I must get to court," I said. I didn't want to get involved in what could turn into a nasty scene.
"Let me past,"
I said, trying to push my way through. But the growing crowd only pressed closer together as they shoved and pushed to get a better view of the scene, blocking the way to the gate. Barrack stood in front of me and began shoving a way through. On the outer fringes of the hurly-burly, more beggars had gathered, working the mob with outstretched hands. A ragged youth stepped in front of me. "Get out of my way," I said irritably, shoving past him to the edge of the crowd.
"Yeah, hunchbacked crow," he shouted.
Just as we pushed through the edge of the crowd, I felt a sharp pain on my upper left arm. At the same moment, I heard my name spoken faintly, a whisper.
"Shardlake."
I cried out and put my other hand to my arm. It came away covered with blood. Harsnett and Barrack turned as I cried out. I lifted the sleeve of my robe, which was torn, to reveal a long rip in my doublet. Blood was seeping through it.
"I've been stabbed,"
I said, feeling subtly faint.
"Take off your robe,"
Barrack said briskly. His eyes darted over the crowd, but it was impossible to see who had done this in the melee. I did as I was bid. Passers-by looked on curiously as Barrack opened the rip of my upper hose wide, then whistled.
"That's some cut. Lucky he missed the artery."
He took his dagger and cut my ruined robe into strips. Then he wrapped the strips round my upper arm, making a tourniquet. The blood gushed faster for a moment, then slowed.
"That needs stitching," Harsnett said. His face was pale.
"I'll take him to the courthouse, then send for Dr. Moulton," Barrack said. "Can you help me?"
"It was him," I breathed. "I heard my name spoken, just as he struck me."
I felt faint. We staggered across New Palace Yard into Westminster Hall. My arm throbbed with pain. My clothes were red with blood. Harsnett spoke to the guard, and I was helped into a little side room where I sat on a bench, my arm held up on Barrack's instructions.
"I'll go and fetch the old Moor," he said.
"Go first to the clerk of requests," I said. "Tell him I've been injured. Ask for today's cases to be adjourned. Then go to Guy." "It's all right, the bleeding's much less," I added, as he looked at me dubiously. "Hurry now."
"I will stay with him,"
Harsnett said. Barrack nodded and left.
"Did you see who it was?"
I asked Harsnett urgently. He shook his head.
"No. The crowd was so thick it could have been any one of those wretched men come to watch these poor shopkeepers."
"It was him."
I clenched my teeth at a sharp stab of pain from my arm.
"He went for Tamazin, and now he's gone for me. He sliced my left arm open. This is another warning."
"But how could he know where you would be today? No one did, surely, save me and Barrack."
"You didn't tell Cranmer you were meeting me? Or the Seymours?"
"No. There was not time last night."
He looked subtly frightened.
"Dear God, what powers has the devil lent this creature?"
My tired brain could see no rational way to answer him, to account for this man's ability to hound us unseen, to know where we were at every move. Suddenly I felt giddy. I closed my eyes and I must have fainted, for the next thing I knew, someone touched my shoulder and I opened my eyes to find the boy Piers standing over me, staring into my face with a look of professional interest. Guy and Barrack were beside him, Barrack looking seriously worried.
You passed out,
Guy said.
It was the shock. You have been unconscious half an hour.
I realized I still was lying on the bench in the little room. Through the closed door, I could hear the bustle and chatter of the courts. From a distance, someone called for the parties and a case to come into court.
You will be sick of the sight of me, Guy. Nonsense. Let's have a look at you.
He undid the tourniquet. A deep gash 3 inches long ran below my shoulder. The red wound, standing out against flesh that was white from being held in the bandage, reminded me horribly of Roger's body, and my head swam again.
Lie back,
Guy said gently, as his fingers probed the wound.
I am going to put an unguent on it that hinders infection, he said. Then we must stitch you up. It will be painful, I am afraid.
Do what is needed, I answered, though my stomach churned.
Barrack, have you been to the court?
I told the office you were taken ill. The clerks went to the judge and he's agreed to stand your cases over.
Barrack hesitated, then continued.
Arsenet says perhaps you shall stand out all of your cases till this business is done. Cranmer or Lord Artford can smooth the path.
It might be a good idea, some of them at least, although I must attend Adam Kite's hearing on the 4th. That's too delicate a matter to hand to someone else. Guy was applying a thick paste to my arm. It stung.
Let us get it properly clean before we stitch it. You'll be in pain for a while, he said. You'll be tired, too, as your body works to mend itself.
He patted my arm.
Let's stitch you up. Piers will do it. Not to worry, he has done it many times now. I will supervise.
The boy approached, delved in his bundle and brought out a thin, sharp needle to which black thread was already attached.
Now remember, Guy told him, slowly and carefully.
The boy put down his bundle and knelt beside me. He smiled.
I will be gentle, sir, he said quietly,
then brought the needle down to pierce my flesh. 2 hours later, I was back home lying on cushions in my parlour. Barrack came in.
Is it arranged? I asked. Yes. The other request barrister would take some of the cases, but the clerks were sniffy about it. I think a message from Cranmer or Lord Artford to the judge would do no harm.
I'll write a note to Harsnett. It was good of him to help you carry me over to Westminster Hall. Not many coroners would have done that.
He's too full of his own rightness in religion for my liking. He really does seem to think the killer is possessed.
He shook his head.
I almost begin to wonder if he could be right.
You, Jack, afraid of devils?
I know, but I can't account for this game of Hoodman Blind the bastard's playing with us. Attacking Tamasin, and now you, vanishing each time like some spirit of the air. And how does he follow us around without being seen?
I've been thinking on that, sitting here. I sat up wincing at a stab from my arm. The killer first murdered the cotter, and my guess is he thought there would be a mighty hue and cry when he was discovered. But everyone blamed the Welsh whore.
Yes.
Next he murdered Dr. Gurney and left him in that pool. A dramatic killing of a prominent man likely to cause widespread public horror. Perhaps, too, he thought someone would make the link to revelation from the way Dr. Gurney was killed, but Cranmer hushed it up.
So he hadn't made the stir he wanted?
No. So then he kills Roger, in a more public manner still. Then he waited for us on the marsh.
He would need to be as crafty and calculating as a fox, and patient as a cat.
And utterly committed to what he's doing. Remember how he hid out in the marsh when we chased him? By then,
He'd seen us. Marked us.
He follows you to your home and me to mine.
Without either of us noticing. Come on, I've followed people before today for Lord Cromwell. It's not easy, especially if there's only one person doing the following. And if it is Goddard, he's supposed to have a great mole on the side of his nose.
I know, I haven't worked out yet how he does it.
And while we hunt him, he hunts us. And today in the crowd, he took an opportunity.
Yes.
How the fuck could he have known we were at Westminster today?
Barrack burst out.
I shook my head. Knew we were at Duett Court, perhaps. But how would he know which court I worked at? The timetable?
I bit the side of my finger.
Unless...
What?
Unless someone is helping him. Telling him our movements.
Thomas Seymour?
Barrack asked, narrowing his eyes.
I don't trust him.
No, Seymour wants him caught.
But I believe someone may be helping him. That makes more sense to me than the devil giving him superhuman powers. I sighed.
I think he spends his whole life planning, waiting,
endlessly, obsessively, working toward the next time he'll break free of all restraints and kill wildly.
And make a spectacle, for that's what he likes.
That's the old Moor talking,
Barrack noted shrewdly.
In any case, here's another question. He's taken hell of a risk attacking you in public, but in that crowd, he could have killed you.
He could have killed Tamasin too. His voice ended on a gulp, and I saw how the whole thing had harrowed him to the core.
Why didn't he?
He wants me to withdraw from the case?
But they'd only appoint someone else.
Yes, they would. It's almost as though the arsehole's taunting us.
One thing's sure, you and I will both have to watch every step we take outside. Be glad we got that man of arsenics in the kitchen.
He clenched his fists.
I spot the bastard who's doing this and I'll kill him with my own hands.
No, we need him alive. I shook my head. Is it Goddard, Barrack?
I don't know.
We're so embroiled in the mystery and terror that it's tempting to clutch at any possibility. I sighed. Whoever he is, I pray we catch him before someone else dies horribly. I frowned. Before he shows us again how clever he is. For surely that is part of it. Barrack's face was still clouded with perplexity and fear. To distract him, I said,
that crowd looked as though it could get nasty.
Bonner's after the player companies as well, then, he said without much interest.
As this morning showed, he could end by stirring up a hornet's nest. One the size of a city.
Aye, there could come a time when the sectaries fight back. Oh, a plague on both sides,
he added irritably.
Indeed, I agreed.
Tell me, by the way, what do you think of Guy's assistant, young Piers?
Didn't much like the look of him.
Bit of a creeper and crawler for all his pleasant manner and pretty face.
He's clever. He sewed your arm up well.
Trouble was, he looked as though he was quite enjoying it.
Guy would say he was learning the detachment of a medical practitioner. I laughed wearily. Remember 18 months ago, when you were hurt in that fall at York and found yourself an invalid?
It's my turn now.
He smiled.
We have seen some troubles.
That we have. Barrack still looked preoccupied. How is Tamasin? I asked tentatively.
Sleeping, he said. She needs to rest.
We were interrupted by a frantic knocking at the door, then urgent voices, Joan's and a man's. Footsteps sounded across the hall. Barrack and I looked at each other.
He struck again, I breathed.
But when the door opened, it was Daniel Kite who stood there, his hair wild, breathing heavily.
"Sir," he said, "you must come. For the love of God, come." "What? It's Adam, sir. He's escaped. He's got himself on top of London Wall out by Bishopsgate. He's calling on the crowds to repent, to forsake the priests and come to God. They'll burn him this time."